originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat He's Had Enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight, he was leading jockey in North America in 1963 and 64. He's won the most prestigious races in the country and rode Hall of Famers Affectionately and Gunbo. He won the Belmont in 1971 with Pass Catcher. He was a recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award in 1965 and was inducted into the Racing Hall of Fame in 87. He's also been inducted into the International Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. With 4,382 wins and over $26 million in earnings, it's a pleasure to introduce jockey Walter Blum. Walter, welcome to the show.
Hello, Christine. I'm glad to be with you.
Can't wait to hear your story, Walter. One of the most successful jockeys of our time. And you grew up in Brooklyn, New York. You were born there anyway. And tell us how you grew up.
I was born there, as you say. I went to school there. I was raised there. And I rode my first race there. Well, actually, my first race was at Jamaica Racetrack in Jamaica. But growing up in New York was one thing. But getting on the racetrack was a big thing in my life. It actually just changed my life, where I became acquainted with very good horsemen, jockeys, and people involved in racing, and I've stayed there all my life.
Walter, you had an interesting start. We've had several other jockeys here on the show, and unlike other guests from the countryside in, say, Louisiana or Virginia, you grew up in this big city, where horses weren't common other than the racetrack. So how did you happen upon the racetrack?
Well, I went to school with a fellow that worked at the track, and we used to horseback riding together. There were a couple of places where you could go horseback riding in Brooklyn, believe it or not. But anyway, he said to me one day, you have a good rapport with the horses, and maybe you would have come with me to the track and see if you can't get a job out there. So I decided to give that a try. And in 1951, I went to Jamaica and went to work for Hirsch Jacobs, who you may know, you may not know. You weren't even born yet. But anyway, that was in 51. And I worked for Hirsch Jacobs, learned all about galloping horses, thoroughbreds. The horses that we went horseback riding in Brooklyn were not like thoroughbreds. Thoroughbreds were quite highly precocious. You had to know how to handle them and get along with them and have good hands on them. So anyway, and I did that for 2 years. I learned all about the thoroughbreds and how to handle them, how to treat them, how to get along with them. And in 1953, in July, I rode my first winner, who was a horse called Tuscania, for Hirsch Jacobs.
You mentioned Hirsch Jacobs. Hirsch Jacobs also trained affectionately, a Hall of Famer. You rode to victories in the 1965 Toboggan and Vagrancy Handicap. And obviously you had a very strong relationship with Hirsch Jacobs to have ridden so many winners for him. And what did he teach you in the beginning, at an early age, when you're a kid and you walk in his barn? What did he teach you?
Well, he taught me the fundamentals of just being around thoroughbred horses, how they react, how to act around them, how to treat them. And I quickly realized that I weighed 100 pounds. They weighed 1,000 pounds. So I wasn't going to outfight them. So the best way to get along with them was to be gentle, be loving, love the horses, which I did. And they're their horses got the idea that I wasn't going to hurt them. And so we got to get along pretty well with them.
Walter, were you always athletic as a kid? Did you play sports in school?
Yes, I played a lot of sports. I was little, but I did play baseball, and I did play ice hockey, and we played sandlot football, which I was not real good at because I was so little. But anyway, I always was athletic. I always was into sports, and so I migrated to the racetrack. I loved the horses. I loved what I did, and I just never left.
So I'm assuming, given your athleticism, when it came time to gallop these thoroughbreds, it came pretty easy for you.
Well, after learning to gallop horses for 2 years, I realized that the lighter hand you had on the horse, the lighter touch you had with the horse, the better rapport you had with the horse. And so I think that carried me a long way through my career, learning how to handle horses and learning about horses.
Walter, I read something very interesting when I was doing research for this show, and that was that you were blind in your right eye. You fell off of a toy horse, and that's how it happened. And so is that true? And did you have any difficulties because of that?
Well, actually, when I was a two-year-old boy, just a little baby, my parents had bought me this little wooden horse, rocking horse, that I rode all over the house. And one day I chipped over the leg of him or whatever, and I banged my eye on his ear, and I blinded my right eye, actually. So I've been blind in my right eye since I'm 2 years old. And having grown up that way, I guess it just never bothered me. The one eye that I had was as good as the two eyes that most people have.
It's pretty amazing, given that riding in races, obviously you rely a lot on your peripheral vision. But as you mentioned, you compensated with the one good eye you had. And in those early days, Walter, obviously you didn't struggle with that. But what didn't come easy for you? What was a little bit more of a struggle when it came to learning how to ride?
Well, if you're talking about my eye, you know, it had no trouble at all. My peripheral vision was probably better than most people's, and I got along with that one eye pretty all my life and still do. As I said, the main thing in my riding career that helped me the most was my love of horses, my respect I had with the horsemen and the jockeys I rode with, and my love for doing what I did. I just couldn't wait to get up in the morning to go out to the track, to work horses, get on horses, and do my thing. So I guess that was why I was so successful in my career. not to mention the fact that I was very lucky not to get hurt real bad.
Any older riders at the time during the early parts of your career, did anyone kind of take you under their wing and teach you?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I rode with some of the best jockeys in the world in those years. One of them was, Eddie Arcaro was one, the master, as we still call him today. He's dead and no longer with us, but he was the best jockey I ever rode with, and he did teach me a lot. Billy Shoemaker and Bill Hartack, Angel Cordero, Milo Valenzuela, Don Pierce, they were all extremely good jockeys. We always had a good rapport in the jockeys' room. There was a lot of good camaraderie between all the jockeys. And if they could ever give you a tip on anything, or as far as what you did wrong or how to correct what you're not doing right, then they were always there for you. So the jockeys in those days were, as I said, there was a lot of camaraderie between us and a lot of friendship between all of us.
What a great group of people to ride with, you just mentioned. That's pretty amazing. How would you describe your own personal riding style?
Well, a lot of people had me down as a speed rider, and I had a good knack of getting out of the gate real quick. I learned real early in my life, that in my career, that if I walked in the gate and I had my horse standing on all four feet, solid on the ground, with his head straight away, looking straight down the track, when those doors opened, he would leave there pretty good. And so I was very adept at leaving the gate. I had a good sense of pace. I knew my horse, if it was going too fast, to slow him down. And that's the reputation I grew up with. However, I did not win 4,300 races all on a lead. A lot of races I rode, I came from off the pace. I came from way back. So I had that reputation, and I did win a lot of races on lead. However, I won a lot of races from way off the lead, too.
Well, so you mentioned you were a small kid growing up, but when it came time to ride races, did you ever struggle with your weight?
Oh yeah, as I continued to ride, I gained a lot of muscle. I gained a lot of strength, and that made me a couple of pounds heavier than I had been to begin with. So yeah, I had to watch my diet. I had to be careful how much I ate. And once in a while, get in a hot box, take off a pound or two, but not as big a problem as some jockeys had. There were some jockeys that I rode with, like Jimmy Nichols or Eric Guerin. And then those guys hit the box every day, take off 3, 4, 5 pounds in a hot box. And if you ever try to do that, I wouldn't suggest it. It's very difficult. So I didn't have too much of a problem with my weight, as other jockeys did, but I had a little bit.
What did your diet consist of?
Nothing. No, I just had a real light breakfast. I'd have a cup of coffee and a slice of toast or egg of some kind. And then at lunch, I might eat a real light salad. And then at night for dinner, I would have anything I wanted, and all I wanted, actually. But I didn't eat a lot of bread. I didn't eat a lot of pasta. I didn't eat the heavy stuff. And so I think that's how I was able to maintain most of my weight. As I said, I didn't have the problem some people had. I saw an article one day that Lafitte Pinquet was on an airplane. The waitress, the girl on the plane asked him what he wanted for dinner. He said, "I'll have a peanut." So I didn't have that kind of a problem, but some jockeys do.
What did your parents and your family think about your chosen career choice?
Well, they weren't too crazy about the idea of me going on the racetrack, leaving school and going on the racetrack. And it was not there. It was not what they had planned for me, I don't think. But in the meantime, when they saw me loving what I did, working hard at what I did, and then becoming successful as I did, they learned to like it.
Were you the only one of your family to ever become involved at the racetrack?
I was the only one of my family to ever become involved at the racetrack. That's right.
It's pretty impressive, and it's sometimes hard for someone who doesn't have family at the racetrack to get a leg up, to get a start. And so you mentioned Hirsch Jacobs. You started working with him. I'm sure he was very important to your career. But how old were you when you first started riding?
I started riding in 1953. I think I was 18. I might have been just going on 18 in the 53, and I rode until I was 41.
Long, illustrious career, Walter. And the 18-year-old kid riding at the racetrack, I'm sure you had to grow up pretty quickly. And did you move around a lot in those early years, or were you primarily located in New York?
Oh, no. I started in New York, but I migrated to New Jersey, and I rode a lot in New Jersey. I rode at Monmouth Park quite often. I rode at Atlantic City also in New Jersey, and I rode at Garden State in New Jersey. In the wintertime, I shifted to Florida a lot, mostly. I rode at Gulfstream a lot, and I rode at Hialeah, which I loved. I also rode a lot in California. When I was an apprentice jockey, my boss, Hirsch Jacobs, took me out to California, and I clicked on this opening day. I won 3 races as an apprentice jockey, and that didn't hurt my career at all. From that time on, I just took off.
That's incredibly impressive.
I did ride all over the place. I rode a lot in Maryland. I rode a lot in, I rode some in Delaware. I rode quite a bit in New York. And a lot in Arlington Park in Chicago. So I've kind of been all over the globe, all over the country riding these races.
Did you have a contract with Hirsch Jacobs during your apprentice year?
Yes, in those days they had contracts, and I had a contract with Hirsch Jacobs. Nowadays they don't have contracts; they have what they call apprentice certificates. So the apprentice holds his own certificate. He doesn't have a contract to anyone. It's a whole different ballgame today, the apprentice situation and racing in general. So, and that's, he has to do another show on that particular subject. But yes, I did have a contract with Hirsch Jacobs. He's a man that I loved, I respected. He learned to respect me and he loved me. He died at an early age, and I still miss him. He was the best person that I could ever know.
I love that. And during that time you had a contract with him, were you allowed to ride for other people if he didn't have a horse in the race?
Exactly. I couldn't ride against Mr. Jacobs if he had a horse in the race. But if he didn't have a horse in the race, I could ride for anyone.
Walter Blum joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So overall, Walter, how did you do that initial apprentice year?
In my apprentice year, I did very well. I didn't become the leading apprentice of the country, but as a matter of fact, Bill Harmetz, who was in California at that time, him and I came very close to being leading apprentice jockeys. And I, to be honest with you, if you ask me if he was a leading apprentice or I was a leading apprentice, I can't really honestly recall that. But I had a very good apprentice year, and I had a lot of much better years after that.
Walter, I know for many jockeys, especially today, the way it is today, as you briefly mentioned, it's sometimes difficult to transition from an apprentice to a journeyman, given you don't have that weight allowance and you're riding against much more experienced jockeys carrying the same weight. So did you find that transition to be difficult at all?
Well, actually, no, because you had the apprentice, you had the apprentice allowance for a year from the date of your first winner. And if you didn't learn how to ride within that year, you weren't going to make it. In the meantime, when I did lose the apprenticeship, of course, you have to carry, your horse has to carry first 10 pounds more or less than the other riders or jockeys. And then you ride 40 winners and you carry 5 pounds less, or 7 pounds less, I'm sorry. And then after you ride 40 winners, you ride 5 pounds less. So I was glad to lose the apprentice because I was starting to get a little heavy, and the weight allowance that I was getting, I didn't get anymore. So I didn't have to carry 100 pounds. I was able to carry 110. So it was a lot easier for me. And my career was such that by the time I lost the apprenticeship, I knew pretty well how to ride.
Obviously, the weights have been raised a bit since that day. What's the lightest you ever had to tack?
I think one time when I was an apprentice jockey, I had carried 99 pounds. So you're allowed to do 5 pounds over, and I think I might have done 3 pounds over. I weighed 102, and I had to starve myself to do that, but that didn't last too long. I won my 40th race pretty quickly, and then I was down to 5 pounds, and so it wasn't that difficult.
Listeners, keep in mind when we say how much you tack, that's a rider with boots, saddle, fully dressed, and safety vest. So it's definitely not easy to maintain that kind of a weight. And Walter, what I know safety wise, we've come a bit of a ways since then as well. What kind of safety gear did you have? Did you have good safety vests and decent helmets?
Oh, no, they didn't have safety vests. When I first started, they didn't have safety vests, and they did not have the helmets that they have today. The helmets they have today, I would say roughly, might weigh 2 pounds, maybe 2.5 pounds. But the jockey's weight, when he checks his weight in today, he doesn't check with his helmet, so the weight of the helmet makes no difference as far as doing weight. So as far as jockey safety vests, they are considerably new compared to when I was riding. So, and those, I don't know what, I'm not sure what they weigh, but they're not very heavy. They're very light in weight. And I would, to guess, I would say they weigh 3 pounds, 2 pounds. I'm not sure.
So Walter, after your apprentice year, I'm sure you continued to ride quite a bit for Hirsch Jacobs, even though you didn't have that contract. Is that true?
Yes. Well, once my contract was over, I was riding for everyone, actually. I went for some of the greatest trainers around, even Hirsch Jacobs. I rode for Eddie Eloy, Frank Whiteley, Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, who's the name of the past, and Laz Barrera, Horacio Luro, Jimmy Crowell, Frank Merrill. I rode some great horses and for those people, and I rode some great horses for Hirsch Jacobs also. As you mentioned earlier, affectionately, was probably one of the best distaff fillies that ever ran. Her half-sister, Priceless Jim, she beat Buck Pass as a 2-year-old at Aqueduct. I think I also wrote a horse called he won the California Derby. Let me see. He won the California Derby. Also, Reason to Hail. Reason to Hail had a real good brother called Hail to Reason, and I didn't ride him. But Mr. Jacobs sent Reason to Hail out to California, And I rode him in the California Derby at Golden Gate Fields. And we won the California Derby out there with that horse. So I continued to ride for Hearst Jacobs all of his life until he died. And then he kind of went, he was out of business. But I was lucky, very lucky to ride some wonderful horses with some wonderful people. I rode for Jimmy Crow, who had Warner Regal, who won the Florida Derby. I rode for Woody Stevens, who won the Louisiana Derby with Northfields. The San Luna Derby with Bold Mesian. And I won every Derby except the really Derby that I wanted to win, which was the Kentucky Derby. But I didn't get that one. But I did ride a bunch of Derby winners.
Who was your agent?
My agent?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you said?
Yes, your agent.
Oh, my agent was Harold Wisman. They called him Fats because he weighed 300 pounds. But Harold Wisman was my agent for 22 or 23 years. And he and I were like brothers. We loved each other. I respected him for doing what he did. And he respected me for doing what I did. And it worked out well that way for all of our riding career.
That's a long time to be with one agent, Walter. You don't really see that these days. But in your opinion, what makes a good agent?
Well, what makes a good agent is, first of all, knowing and having a good relationship with the trainers on the grounds. In fact, the trainers nationwide. You have to have a good relationship and a good rapport with them. And you have to be honest with them at all times, you know. And so when I say honest with them, I mean, if they want you to ride in the seventh race tomorrow and you have them out that you know you got to ride, you can't tell them, oh, well, wait a minute, I'll let you know tomorrow and stuff like that. So Fats, which is what they called my agent, his nickname is Fats. The funny thing about Fats, we'll call him, was that one day I told him that, you know, Fats, I rode this horse last week. I forget her name, but anyway, I said, please don't put me on her again because she is nothing. She's not worth the saddle that I got. He said, look, you be the jockey. Let me be the agent. I have a race picked out for her in a week from now that she will just win. So I just let it go. And sure enough, a week later, I see myself named on the same horse. And don't you know, she won from here to across the street. So I never told him who to ride, when to ride, if to ride, if not to ride again. I just let him do his thing. And he let me do my thing. And the other thing that makes a good agent also is being able to read the condition book of the races that are coming up today, tomorrow, next week, and the week after. And they're all listed in what they call a condition book. And if you're a good agent, you know what horse is going in what race and who has that horse. And you go to that trainer and try to get on his horse, whoever you think is the best horse, and you might sign up to ride this particular trainer's horse a week from now, 10 days from now. And that makes you a good agent.
I love that story. Folks, we will continue our visit with jockey Walter Blum after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judges' choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit Tito'sVodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Pena of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcott. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined this evening by jockey Walter Blum. Walter, welcome back. Would like to start the second half of the show off by talking about your Belmont victory in 1971 with Pass Catcher. And you denied the Triple Crown victory that year. And tell us about how you acquired the mount and what was he like to ride?
Well, Pass Catcher was a really talented kind of horse. He had just gotten beat in the Jersey Derby, not maybe 2 weeks before this. And I knew that had that race been just a little further, he would have won the Jersey Derby. So up come the Belmont Stakes, and Eddie Yowell, who trained Pass Catcher, said, you know, I'm thinking about running this horse in the Belmont. What do you think? I said, believe me, wherever you run him, he's going to be right there. And he wants a little more distance ground because the Jersey Derby, I think, was a mile and an eighth. I think that's what it was. So anyway, he entered him in the Belmont. And in the Belmont was Ken O'Neill, who had just, he won the Derby. He won the Preakness. And he was trying to win the Triple Crown in the Belmont. So now, when we were galloping, when we came out of the paddock and we walked onto the track, and I let my horse warm up, Pass Catcher was, I mean, he was just full of himself. He just couldn't wait to run. And right then and there, I knew he was going to win. Well, at least I thought he was going to win. And I looked at the tote board. This guy was 35 to 1. I thought to myself, man, he's going to be one of the biggest payoffs in the Derby's history, in the Belmont's history. Make that long story short, returned for home. I opened up about five lengths. And Ken O'Neill, to be honest with you, he was not the Ken O'Neill that won the Belmont, I mean, the one the Derby and the Preakness. He just wasn't the same horse. He wasn't himself. He probably had too much of a campaign. Or whatever it was, he didn't run his race. However, Pass Catcher did, and that's how he won the Belmont. He was a fantastic horse. He had a lot of ability, and that was his day.
Well, and didn't you also survive a claim of foul?
Yeah, but it was kind of a pony claim of foul. Eddie Belmonte, he rode, I can't think who he rode, but Angel Cordero, who was like Eddie Belmonte's brother. So Belmonte claimed a foul against me. Like, when I crossed over the field, I was about two lengths in front of him. And he stood up like he was going to get the Academy Award, like I bothered him. So he claimed a foul, hoping to get his brother, Angel Cordero, who finished second. He was trying to get him, the stewards, to take me down, and that was an impossibility. Anyway, the numbers blinked. They blinked three or four times, and they made it official. It was a bit of a joke, but I understood Belmonte and I understood Cordero, and, you know, they were trying their best to win it, and I was trying my best to win it. So, but there was no anything near a foul, and they had no chance of taking that number down.
That had to be quite a victorious triumph for you there in 1971. If I remember correctly when reading, I think back in 1959, Sword Dancer's year, that there was a spill, and you were aboard Lake Erie, I believe, and obviously much different outcome than in 1971.
Yeah, Eddie Alcow, I was riding a horse called, Lake Erie. And Eddie Alcow was riding a horse called Black Hills. And I was way back. My horse might have been 70 to 1, 80 to 1. He shouldn't even have been in a race. But anyway, as he went around, left the 3/8 pole, in the middle of the turn, Eddie's horse broke his leg, Black Hills. And when he did, he fell sideways of the race. He felt like sideways of the race. Anyway, I couldn't miss him. The only thing I could do was get ready to hit the prone horse who was on the racetrack. And we collided. Carol was already down in the mud. I was catapulted about 50 feet away. But Alcaro was drowning in the mud, actually. So I crawled over to Alcaro, and with that came along one of the track security people, and we pulled his head out of the mud. And make that story short, Sword Dancer won the race with Shoemaker. Black Hills was destroyed at the track. And my horse, he went on to race again, but he was in the wrong race at the wrong time.
So Eddie Alcaro basically had you to thank for saving his life that day, not drowning in the mud, as you mentioned. And you did have another spill, Walter. I actually watched the replay. And looked pretty horrific back in 1965 at Santa Anita. And what happened that day?
Well, that was pretty horrible. Up until that time, I had gotten a few injuries, a few minor things happened. But in that particular day, I was riding a horse. What was his name? Anyway, I was riding this horse, and he was a darn good horse. Steve Ippolito was the trainer. And Jack Hogan, he was the owner. Anyway, we came around the last turn, and as he approached the quarter pole, my horse snapped his leg. And there were 11 horses behind me, 10 or 11 horses behind me. And when he snapped his leg and fell, of course I fell with him, and man, the whole field ran over me. And if you see the race, if you see the tape, it looks like I got killed, but I had a bunch of broken ribs. I had a vertebrae injury. Anyway, I was lucky I didn't get killed that particular day. And I wound up coming. That was at Santa Anita the opening day. I forget. But anyway, it was a bad time for me. I wound up in the hospital. I didn't know if I was going to ride again. However, the doctors told me I'd be okay if I just followed their routine. And I wound up coming back to San Lita and riding before the meeting was over. And that amazed a lot of people. But being fit and being athletic, you can overcome a lot of stuff. And so I was lucky I did.
That's a quick comeback. Most definitely.
Yeah, good comeback.
Walter, let's talk for a minute about one of the best horses you ever rode, Hall of Famer Gunbo. And you beat Kelso in the 1964 Woodward Stakes. And
Gunbo was one of my favorite horses. He was trained by Eddie Nidoy. He was a fantastic horse. And if And if Kelso hadn't been around in those years, he would have been a horse of the year. He would have been everything. But but Kelso was a top horse. But Gunbo, he beat him a couple of times. Gunbo won the Metropolitan Handicap. He won the Brooklyn Handicap at Aqueduct. He won so many good races. He was just a wonderful horse to ride. And easy horse to ride. He let you know when it was time to go, and as soon as you asked him to run, he let it go. Mr. Prospector was one of my outstanding horses. Also, he set the fastest track record at Gulfstream Park that was ever run, which was 3/4 mile, 7.4. I think that's been tied since then. But he was a top horse. Eddie Kroll, trainer. Another horse I rode for Eddie Kroll was Parker. He won the United Nations Handicap at Atlantic City. I'm talking about quite a while back, but he was a special horse. Affectionately was Sir Jacobs' horse, the mare that I was talking about. She was unbeatable. She was just something else. She won the Vagrancy Handicap carrying 132 pounds when everybody in the race was carrying 112, 110, 111. So she was something else. Her half-sister, Priceless Gem, she beat Buck Bass as a 2-year-old in the Belmont Futurity at Aqueduct. It was the Belmont Futurity, but it was at Aqueduct. And I can't tell you what kind of horse she was. She was unbelievable. Of course, you know about Bass Catcher. And I wrote a horse called Baffle for, believe it or not, for Johnny Longdon. Ex-jockey you may have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you had. And Baffle, he won a big race at San Lita, but then he went out and won the Del Mar Futurity. And that was a big race for him. He was one of my special horses. And I rode a horse called Distinctive, another outstanding horse. And I rode a filly called Myrtle's Jet. She won the Alcibiades Stakes. Now, these races I'm talking about, they were all 25,000, 50,000. Today, those races that I just mentioned, they were all 100,000, 200,000, big races. But it was a pleasure to ride them in those days. The money was just secondary. It was the competition and the win that made it special.
Walter, you have quite the resume. You just named off some of the greatest horses in history. And if you look back, I mean, you've won the Whitney, Santa Anita Derby, the Frisette, the Tremont, the Brooklyn Handicap, the Belmont, just to name a few. The list goes on and on and on. But more than being an incredibly successful jockey, I believe I read at the time of your retirement, there were only 4 other jockeys who had won more races than you. Eddie Arcaro, I think, was on that list as well. But more than that, you're also so highly respected among your peers. You were president of the Jocks Guild for quite some time, and you were a recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award. And when you won that award, Walter, what was that feeling like?
Well, to win the George Wolfe Memorial Award, a jockey has to conduct himself with great respect. Also, always a gentleman. I'm the kind of guy that has a rapport with his peers. The horsemen, everybody involved in racing has to respect you. And to win the George Wolfe Memorial Award was like sort of like winning the Academy Award, you know. For a jockey to win that, it's a big feather in their cap, and I was very proud, and I'm always happy to say that I won that award in 1965. I also was inducted into the Hall of Fame, as you know, in 1987, and that was also a feather in my cap. You know, for a young kid from Brooklyn, in 1950 or 51, to be inducted into the Racing Hall of Fame in Saratoga in 1987. It's like becoming president of the United States. So I can't tell you how proud I am of the George Wolfe Award, of the Hall of Fame Award, And being president of the Jockeys Guild, which I worked real hard at.
Walter, you were president of the Jockeys Guild from 1969 to 1975. And what did that position entail? What were you responsible for?
Well, the Jockeys Guild is comprised of jockeys, actually. And they do what they can to represent the jockeys, active jockeys at that time, and to try to betterment their lives as jockeys. For instance, raising the scale of weights, getting automatic first, second, third money from trainers. Like when I was riding and you won a race, you had to go to the trainer's barn the next day and hope to get a check for the win. Now, since then, I think that was, that might have been 1970 or 71, that we had that change to where it was an automatic deduction out of the horseman's account, that if I won a $10,000 race, I had $1,000 coming, and we wanted the horseman's bookkeeper to deduct that out of the horseman's account, automatic. So the jockey no longer had to worry about his 10%. It was automatic. It had to be paid, and that was a giant, big item. We also increased the insurance for the jockeys, which when they got hurt in those days, they got $50 a week, I think it was. Well, you know what $50 a week is. So anyway, we got that raised, and I don't know what today what they get, but it was more than they got in '69. And when I retired as the president of the Jockeys Guild, you have to retire. I had to retire in '75 because I retired as an active jockey, and you have to be an active jockey to be president. So I think who took over for me. I can't think who took over for me, but anyway, I did what I could for the Jockeys Guild. They were happy to have me as their president. They respected me. We had a great rapport with the jockeys and owners and trainers. And I think I really did a good job for the Jockeys Guild.
I can't imagine going to a trainer's bar now and just hoping you get paid for your win. And so that is quite an accomplishment to have.
And that was big. That was big because before that, you could go to the trainer's barn and he'd say, oh, yeah, well, I'm waiting for my owners to send me a check. Or, you know, I can't afford to pay you this week, but next time you win, you know, so there's a million excuses. And lots of times, a jockey didn't get what he had coming. So once we changed that to an automatic deduction from their accounts, it worked out wonderful, and it's working out wonderful even today. And another thing that you may not know is that jockeys nowadays get 10% of first, second, third, and fourth of races over, I don't know, 25,000, whatever it is. And you're talking about big money. I mean, these jockeys today, I wish I was riding today. These jockeys today make more money than I made in their life in a year of riding. But I don't begrudge that. I'm glad they're improving every day, and I'm glad they get what they get. They deserve it. Because every time they get on the horse, they take their life in their hands. And there's lots of them with the PDJF that are getting money through the Paralyzed Jockeys Fund that they would never be getting had it been in the old days.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Walter, just to remind folks, if you're able to help with the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So, Walter, what other changes have you seen in the racing industry since you first started riding?
Well, I've seen a lot of changes. I've seen, for instance, the tapes that they have of the races today, as per the films that they had when I was a jockey. You don't know this, but after each race, when I was a jockey in the 50s and 60s, there was a station wagon that followed the field around the track. And the guy would get out, the driver would get out at the film patrol tower. And the film patrol tower would throw down a film. And the guy would catch it in the baseball glove. He would go to the next one, an eighth of a mile away, half mile away, and catch that one. Then he would go to the top of the stretch and catch that one. And then he would take all three of those and and develop them real fast and look at a DQ or an infraction or whatever took place. That was in the 50s and 60s. Now they have these high technical situations that they have with these, where they can get the live running of the tape of the race while it's being run and see what's going on. So that's a big improvement. Another big improvement is with the stewards today. The stewards today, they have to have a background, a racetrack background. It's such a big help, not only to them, but to the trainers, jockeys, owners, and everybody else, and the betting public. Because when I was hired by Dan Bradley in 1977, I was hired as a Florida State steward. And the question he asked me was, Walter, why does it take so long for an infraction or claim of foul to be, to see what happened? I said, and I told him that I don't care how long it takes, as long as what they, their final decision is correct. And he hired me on the spot. I was the state steward from 77 to 2004. And whenever we took a number down or disqualified a jockey or suspended a jockey, we never had any appeal. We might have had one appeal from a trainer that was dissatisfied with our call. But in the meantime, stewards today have to know what they're looking at, who they're looking at, how the infraction occurred, and so many things. And they have to know when they make a decision, that decision not only costs the jockey, the horse owner, the trainer, who puts up all everything. It also involves the people that bet on the horses. And they have to realize that. And when they make a decision, they better be right. Because the first time they're not right, they're in trouble.
You're definitely correct in saying it's come a long way. I actually went to the Racing Official Accreditation Program, which they have going on now, which is a wonderful thing available to potential racing officials. But Walter, let's talk about that. We only have a couple minutes left. This hour's flying by. But when you retired in 1975, I believe it was, how was that transition for you, going from jockey to racing official? And did you miss it?
Well, did I miss it? Yeah, I still miss being a jockey, that's for sure. But getting back to the Stewards Accreditation Program, you know, I really think, and I always have thought, and I still think, that I don't care how much time you put in the accreditation program. If you don't put some time in the backstretch, if you don't put some time in the front stretch, if you don't work on the racetrack, just going to the accreditation program does not accredit you to be a steward. You have to know the people. You have to know the situation that occurred, that can occur. You have to know the problems of the people, the grooms, the exercise riders, everybody involved in the racetrack industry. You have to know all about that. And you don't learn all that in the steward accreditation program. The steward accreditation program is a good thing, but you got to have some background in the backstretch too. And if you don't have it, you don't have it.
You're exactly right. Couldn't have said it better myself, which was why you were the perfect candidate to be state steward in Florida and a racing official further up north as well. Did you enjoy your time spent as state steward?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed being a state steward. First of all, it was something I always wanted to do when I stopped riding. I came up under the best steward in the country, Gordon Potter, Earl Potter, I'm sorry. Earl Potter, Keen Dangerfield, Marshall Cassidy, some of the best stewards in the country. And I patterned myself after those people. I tried to act toward the licensees the same way that they would. I did my job the way I saw fit. And I was very glad to have done my job as a state steward as I did.
Walter, you mentioned, back talking about your riding career again, you mentioned all of the different places you rode. You've literally ridden all over the country. And I love that you were also steward and you rode at Atlantic City. I was one of the last people to ride at Atlantic City when it was open for business. But let me ask you this. What was your favorite racetrack to ride at?
That's probably the toughest question you asked. Gulfstream was one of the best. Hialeah was a very top place. Santa Anita was outstanding. Oh, my God. You hit me with one I wasn't ready for. I think maybe Monmouth Park might have been my favorite. Gulfstream Park also. You know, I rode at so many good racetracks that I can't put my finger on one. Saratoga, of course, stands out, but you know, too many good ones.
Monmouth Park, you mentioned you were one of only four jockeys to ever win six races on a single card. I just wanted to mention that before we go here, Walter. Only about a minute left. Tell us what you're doing now.
Well, now I'm getting old like everybody else is. I'm trying to keep myself in as best condition as I can, which is not very good. I try to play golf once or twice a week. And that's working out considerably well, but what can I tell you? Time passes, we get older, and we just take one day at a time.
I love it, Walter. I want to give a special thanks to your son, Walter Blum Jr., for giving me your phone number, getting you on the show. Really appreciate it, Walter, and wishing you all the best.
Hey, thank you so much, and look forward to hearing the rerun of this.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, and of course, Express Bet Radio. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.